Getting back to our origin of We the People. Tackling current issues, both political and legal, with common sense. As We the People, we must bring common sense back to make our lives better. Only on Now Media TV.
Good evening and welcome to We the People. I am Alina Gonzalez-Dockery, your hostess. Tonight we're tracking stories that cut to the heart of American democracy. From academic freedom under fire to the shifting sands of political power, these aren't just headlines. They're reshaping our nation's future. And Trump only being in power for 50 days, things are definitely being shaken up. So let's dive in. The battle for academic freedom. Tonight we begin at Columbia University, where an unprecedented faculty civil war has erupted. What we're witnessing isn't just an academic dispute, it's a battle for the soul of American higher education. Columbia's universities fighting two wars at once. One rages publicly against President Trump, whose administration in recent days ordered the arrest of a student protester, Khalil Mamoun, and canceled federal funds to this Ivy League school over allegations of anti-Semitism. And that is $400 million, people. Trump's administration canceling $400 million in federal grants and contracts to Columbia University last week. The school pledged to work with the government to restore funding. On Monday, Harvard University announced a freeze on staff and faculty hiring, citing substantial financial uncertainties driven by rapidly shifting federal policies. Of course, some would say they do have billions and billions of dollars in endowment funds that could help still fund some of these grants or these grant-related research projects. But I digress. The second conflict simmers behind the scenes, a faculty civil war that pits medical doctors and engineers against political scientists and humanities scholars over how to handle pro-Palestinian demonstrations that have sometimes verged on pro-Hamas rhetoric and how it has disrupted campus life, especially those of the Jewish and Israeli student body. But beyond these conflicts lies the fundamental question, who should control America's universities? The conflict at Columbia represents more than just an internal dispute. It's a microcosm of our national debate about academic freedom versus institutional accountability. Divisions often exist between disciplines at colleges, but the fissures cut particularly deep at Columbia because of the high number of both Jewish faculty who support Israel and faculty who believe Israel is committing a genocide against the Palestinians. What's particularly significant is how this mirrors similar tensions at other Ivy League and universities across the nation. Those faculty more sympathetic to Palestinians control key committees on the Faculty Senate at Columbia University and have sought to limit discipline against protesters and restrictions on protests. Remember last year where they were taking over buildings, defiling buildings, breaking windows, destroying offices, which is not protected free speech, which explains why Columbia didn't restrict student disruptions on campus as aggressively as other schools, according to interviews with faculty members. Across campus, scientists and engineers have been less invested in the protest, partly, several said, because they were too focused on their work to get involved. Now, those researchers are being disproportionately punished by having grants and contracts canceled. What's particularly significant is how this mirrors similar tensions at other universities like Harvard, which are changing policies and eliminating DEI departments to prevent cancellation of grants and funding. President Trump has taken a firm stance against universities that he perceives as having inadequate policies to combat anti-Semitism. Throughout his political career, including during his first term and now in his second, Trump has consistently emphasized a hardline approach to addressing anti-Semitism on college campuses, His position is rooted in the belief that universities failing to protect Jewish students are allowing what Trump describes as anti-Semitic propaganda should face significant consequences, including the loss of federal funds, grants, and accreditation. Due to the failure of leadership at the university, who did not heed many, many warnings, Trump had no choice. Quote, Ari Shrag, co-founder of the Columbia Jewish Alumni Association. And nowhere in this movement more evident than in Florida, where Governor Ron DeSantis has already implemented what Trump is proposing. So let's take a look at that impact. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has a three-year head start. A series of laws redefines general education requirements, bans some subjects from the classroom, and emphasizes others across the state's 40 public colleges and universities. In February, DeSantis announced an initiative to target state-level waste and fraud and to make sure that these universities are really serving the classical mission of what a university should be. And that's not to impose ideology. It's really to teach students how to think and prepare them to be citizens of our republic. The state's flagship campus offers a look at where the rest of the country might be heading. The changes have begun to shift centers of campus power, alter sources of anxiety, and reshuffle the academic hierarchy and social norms. The higher ed legislation adopted in Florida is both sweeping and granular. It bans political or social activism while also mandating a shared understanding of Western civilization. The goal, proponents say, is to trigger a seismic cultural shift that pivots campus discourse away from critics of America with an emphasis of differences between groups toward an appreciation of heritage that binds Americans together. Among the first notable changes at UF, with an enrollment of more than 60,000 students, came last year when the school cut 28 full and part-time positions on the DEI staff and scrubbed university websites of DEI language. This past fall, students learned the Center for Inclusion and Multicultural Engagement had been renamed the Office of Community and Belonging. I, as a alumnus of University of Florida, I can tell you it is unbelievable that race has become such a grand issue when we used to not care if somebody was gay, somebody was black, somebody was Spanish. Hello, Spaniard right here. But it has become so divisive. So is it so bad? I guess that's the big question. Is it so bad that we actually go, you know what? We used to have inclusion. We used to not be so divided by race. And I'm going to tell you, for one, these protests, one is to have a protest. I was there at University of Florida when the Nazis and the skinheads would have their permitted approved parades down the street. And yes, we protested against them, but there was never violence. And guess what? That's First Amendment right. That is free speech. Yes, you have a right to burn your flag, our flag. That is protected under the First Amendment. But to threaten physical harm, to attack fellow students, to vandalize university buildings, to trap students that have to be for their own safety and protection in a library while you are trying to break down windows is not protected speech. And that's where we go from here. Marco Rubio stating that Khalil, who is seen as a protester, just a mere green card holder, a permanent resident who's just protesting in favor of Palestine, but yet his protest, his language mirrors that of Hamas, and his mission that is part of his organization that he created is the annihilation and destruction of the West. The United States is the face of the West. And yes, though there are protesters out there and Jews for Palestine trying to say that this young man should be freed, should he? He's here on a green card, which is mean he only has permanent resident status. He is not afforded all of the legal protections as a citizen. And one of the things that he has vowed in his pledge to the United States to obtain this legal residency is to uphold the United States Constitution, but also to be a friend, not a foe, of the United States culture. That is what Marco Rubio is stating. But one thing is for certain, that this has now become so divisive that we are having rampant anti-DEI go through the university systems. Any university that is deemed to be weak on anti-Semitism is looking at funding cuts, grants being negated. And let's just face it, one of the contrary things is the fact that, as you can see, Florida may be the mirror that, or what is going to be mirrored throughout the United States. We have already been having this for 3 years, and professors are steering away from topics they think could violate state law and have been frustrated by the new rules impression. What constitutes DEI? What is advocacy? What defines the Western canon? These are all still major points to be fleshed out. Beyond the Classrooms, a campus student news organization declined to cover another student organization. This is a University of Florida event because it discussed the impacts of laws prohibiting DEI. And the journalists feared a coverage would compromise their funding, according to a lawsuit filed in January by six Florida professors who are being represented by the ACLU. Nadine Strossen, a former ACLU president, said the chill on speech generated by government action now coming from both Democrats and Republicans, because remember, on the opposite side, if you were anti-DEI, if you tried to state that this is wrong, if you were saying, no, I am pro-Israeli, you got shut down just as quickly. So while this battle rages in our universities, another power shift is taking place in Washington. When we return, we'll explore how Democratic retirement could reshape the Senate and these very education policies we're discussing. Stay with us after this break.
To our origin of We the People. Tackling current issues, both political and legal, with common sense. As We the People, we must bring common sense back to make our lives better. Only on Now Media TV.
Welcome back. The Senate's balance of power hangs by a thread, and that thread is getting thinner, with three Democratic senators announcing their retirements, including Senator Jeanne Shaheen of Connecticut. The 2026 map has become increasingly complex. After losing four seats and control of the Senate in 2024, Democrats entered the 2026 cycle confronted by a 53-47 Republican majority and a daunting map with a seemingly few offensive opportunities. The retirements of these three incumbents in Minnesota, Michigan, and now New Hampshire is where Senator Jeanne is from, have only further complicated matters. President Donald Trump has won Michigan in two of the last three election cycles, and all three open seats will require money and resources to defend against Republicans hoping to expand the majority. It's a challenging reality for a party that should be looking at a favorable cycle. Midterm elections have historically been a bright spot for the party out of power in the White House, which tends to gain seats in Congress as voters weigh in on the president's leadership, such as the 2022 midterm, where it saw the House, the Republicans, take a very slim majority. And sometimes that majority didn't always work out, but now we're looking at the 2026, and I know everybody's like, but we just got off of a presidential election. Why are we talking about 2026 midterms? Because, believe it or not, it's starting. We are in it. We are now in a forever election cycles, pretty much. 2026 is a key cycle for Democrats, whose best shot at reclaiming the Senate in future cycles rests on netting seats next year. And now, especially with filibustering of the protection of women's sports and killing that bill in the Senate and the backlash that the Democrats are having, the Republicans are now, for the first time, saying, let's get 60 seats. So you have this influx, and this is why they are holding on by the slimmest of threads. Republicans have portrayed the trio of retirements as a sign that next year could defy past trends. Incumbents don't retire when they think they're about to have an easy reelection, said GOP strategist Corey Bliss. Incumbents retire when they think, holy poop, this environment is going to suck. Democrats' chances of weathering the cycle may hinge in part on Republicans' continued recruitment challenges. The GOP has lost winnable seats in recent years with controversial Trump-backed candidates such as Herschel Walker in Georgia, Dr. Mehmet Oz, who is now on the cabinet in Pennsylvania, and Carrie Lake in Arizona. And I will hold my opinion on why these two, actually, let's not. Herschel Walker, bad candidate, great football player, amazing philanthropist, bad candidate. But he did go into a runoff. He was just a poor candidate for at that time. But you also have to remember he was running in 2022. There was a backlash on Trump because of the 2020 and the Jan 6 and all of that. And he did run. I mean, it was a slim loss for Herschel. Carrie Lake, Arizona is more purple than red. It's a reddish purplish, I guess, if you could say that. But it's not that deep red. And Carrie Lake is a forever Trumper. And that is why she lost. She cannot concede certain points. And she was actually too far to the MAGA side that it actually, though Trump won Arizona, she couldn't carry that first thing. But let's go back to the Democrats. Because let's face it, the Democrats are getting hammered. They need to figure out what their position is. This super extreme, woke, leftist, progressive itinerary that they have in agenda is not appealing to the United States constituency. You know, we the people. And we discussed this last week. So the first blow to Democrats came in late January when Michigan Senator Gary Peters, the outgoing chair of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, announced that he was retiring. Weeks later, Minnesota Democratic Senator Tina Smith made a retirement announcement of her own. Smith described her retirement, along with those of her colleagues, as a personal decision about how to spend the next decade of their lives. Incumbency is a powerful, powerful advantage. And losing it in those states is a blow to the party. With Shaheen's departure, Democrats are suddenly faced with the prospect of contending in three open seats, including two in Midwest states that have been trending toward Republicans in recent election cycles. And remember that with Trump's win in 2024, we saw 89 counties shifting to the right. We saw all swing states shifting towards Trump. And you'll see that more and more rural areas are shifting more red in what is traditionally strongholds of blue states. In a potential boon to Republicans, former GOP New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu told the Washington Examiner earlier this week that he hasn't ruled out a run for the seat. And Chris Sununu is very popular among his constituency, so this could be a hard battle. When you look at the bigger picture, it's better to have open seat races in these places in the first midterm of Trump's administration than 6 years from now when it's going to be a presidential year and we don't know what the dynamics are going to be, she said. And that would be Sheehan's. Crowded, Rambunctious primaries could be good testing grounds for the eventual Democratic nominee in each state, but they could just as easily divide party factions already at odds over the best path forward in the wake of losses in 2024. Drawn-out primaries could also strain campaign budgets that were already set to be tested in what's expected to be one of the most expensive midterm election cycles in history. So this brings us to the immediate challenge, the looming budget showdown. Democrats' first big chance to check Trump may make them look even weaker and further their downfall among the American people. Washington Democrats finally have a first point of leverage against President Donald Trump. But it comes with a dilemma that could lead them looking even more hapless than they have so far in his second term. The pressure point arises over a temporary government funding bill that could provide cover for the president's anti-government purge and as Democratic voters pine for their lawmakers to show some fight. Ahead of a critical Senate vote, Democratic leaders face a paradoxical choice. Should they shut down the government to try to save it? That gamble could come with a significant downside, as shuttered agencies and thousands of furloughed federal workers could be left even more vulnerable to the metaphorical chainsaw wielded by Elon Musk. And remember, they already filibustered. So you see, the House is basically telling Johnson, you know what? You need to get your own votes. We're not going to come to the table with this. And let's remember, this bill, the proposed CR, was not dropped till Saturday, and the Democratic leadership were already making all of these claims on Friday before they even obtained the proposed continuing resolution, which Johnson addressed. And remember, this is also coming after the senators filibustered the protection of girls' sports, biological female sports, and keeping men, whether they want to say claim they are female or not, sorry, to those transgender females or women, as they'd like to be called. It was protecting girls' sports. It was keeping men out of the girls' locker rooms. It's preventing men dressed as women or claiming, not even dressed as women, claiming that they are women to try to get into spas where it's only women and to make us feel uncomfortable. Sorry, you can have your own spaces. Don't come into mine. But so the Democrats' choices will play out against a backdrop of mounting frustration from progressives whose despair after the 2024 election has turned to horror as Trump has turned Washington upside down in his first 50 days. And again, he's just like executive order, executive order, executive order. And yes, there's legal battles, but he's still going forward. And set about fracturing the liberal world order that has prevailed over 80 years. Democrats are wildly mocked for their ineffectual protests that underscored their impotence during Trump's joint address to Congress earlier this month when some wore color-coordinated dresses, pinks for women empowerment, while they filibustered protection of biological female sports. Hypocritical mendacity. I will always come after you for that. And others held up paddles like they were at a frickin' auction bearing anti-Trump slogans because that's what we're going to do. Hey, again, I'm proud of you for not bringing the noisemakers, but you guys look clownish. And at times, I honestly, AOC, she boycotted it. Maybe she was probably one of the smartest, and she's not a smart person. She does not come off as an intellectual. Her staying home was probably the best move. But you know what? Get your act together, Democrats. Are you really going to shut down the government? Because you always say, oh, it's the Republicans' fault. Guess what? Na-na-na-na, boo-boo, Shoemaker, you're on. Shut it down. What's that going to do? It's actually going to work in favor of Doge. I mean, Doge may actually win no matter what happens. Democrats fear this stopgap bill will simply provide another 6 months for Trump and Musk to widen the Department of Government Efficiency's plan to fire thousands of workers and close entire federal departments. But hey, let's do a complete shutdown and we'll show them, right? Oh, and by the way, folks, while you're going, why are you against this? Congressional members will still get paid. Just saying. Senate Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer sought to break Democrats out of their unenviable political box on Wednesday, warning that the 60 votes needed to pass the funding bill do not yet exist. And he called for a separate one-month extension to allow us to come together and talk. At this point, the Democrats' sole purpose is whatever Trump wants, we're not going to allow, and it's a bust and a bust and a bust. But there are some senators willing to break with it. Fetterman comes to mind. Fetterman is quoted as, if you shut it down, meaning the government, you will impact and hurt millions and millions and millions of Americans, and you run the risk of slipping us into a recession or even all kinds of other things. And speaking of, so Fetterman, who is starting to rise, he is a star rising, and on at times, sometimes even people on the right say, wow, he makes a lot of sense. Now, yes, he joined the other senators and filibustered the trans athletes being able to compete in women's sports. But oftentimes he says, we have to come to the table. He is one of the few Democrats willing to work with the Republicans to ensure that our government continues to go forward. And speaking of political futures, some Democrats aren't waiting for 2028. When we return, we're going to explore how potential presidential candidates are already positioning themselves for 2028. So they're not even waiting for 2026 to pass. So tune back in while we talk about 2028 presidential landscape on the Democratic side.
Getting back to our origin of We the People. Tackling current issues, both political and legal, with common sense. As We the People, we must bring common sense back to make our lives better. Only on Now Media TV.
While 2028 might seem a distant time period, and some of us are still going, finally, the campaign period is over. We can rest. We can relax. We just got done with our presidential campaign. The Democratic presidential field is already starting to take shape with some surprising early moves. Buttigieg, Newsom, Pritzker among the Democrats making what appear to be early moves in the 2028 presidential race. The early moves in the next White House race, at least among the Democrats, are getting underway. Mayor Pete on Thursday ruled that a run for an open Democrat-held Senate seat in his adopted home state of Michigan, where he moved to after serving as Secretary of Transportation for the Biden administration and formerly the mayor of Indianapolis since Mayor Pete. And the announcement by the 2020 Democratic presidential candidate who served 4 years as transportation secretary appears to clear the path for a potential 2028 White House bid by Mayor Pete. Buttigieg highlighted that while my own plans don't include running for office in 2026, I remain intensely focused on consolidating, communicating, and supporting a vision that is an alternative to what he called the cruel chaos of President Donald Trump's administration. A source familiar with Mayor Pete thinking told Fox News that the former transportation secretary is in a strong possible position to run for president in 2028, and that running for either senator or Michigan governor in 2026 would have taken that off the table. Newsom, Governor Newsom of California, makes major headlines in the inaugural edition of his new podcast, which we reported last week. Across the country, term-limited California Governor Gavin Newsom, who has long been suspected by of harboring national ambitions is grabbing tons of attention and millions of YouTube hits thanks to a new and very high-profile podcast series. The first two guests were MAGA World superstars Charlie Kirk and Steve Bannon. Democrat J.B. Pritzker, the billionaire two-term governor of Blue State Illinois and one of his party leaders in opposing President Donald Trump's second-term agenda, will head to New Hampshire next month to headline the state party's annual fundraising gala, sparking plenty of 2028 speculation. Trips to New Hampshire, which for over a century has held the first primary in the race for the White House, are seen as an early indicator of a politician's interest in running for the presidency in the next election. But there's more. There is plenty of focus on former Vice President Kamala Harris, who replaced then-President Joe Biden as the Democratic Party's 2024 presidential nominee last summer after he dropped out of the race, or, I will opine, in my opinion, was booted out, backstabbed to get out of the race. But then some people are like, but she just ran and lost. Well, it was like a microcosm campaign, and it definitely showed a lot of flaws in her ability to run on a major campaign threshold. And let's recall, in 2019, she was not that great. But Kamala Harris is to reveal her own timetable. Harris, who lost last November, is seriously considering a 2026 bid to succeed Gavin Newsom in her home state of California. But a run for governor in 2026 would likely derail her from making a 2028 White House bid. And of course, you can only have two alphas in one state. Look at Florida. We have Governor DeSantis and Donald Trump. Those two butted heads because of the primary. You're not going to have that. And Kamala's last bid and her first bid in 2019 for the Democratic primary showed a lot of flaws in her personality and issues with likability. She has a big, big turnaround that she needs to make in how she portrays herself. Whereas Gavin, don't support probably a lot of his political stances, especially what he's done in California, and knowing that California is in a major deficit, and this is even before the fires. But one thing is for sure, tall, good looking, great voice, and this latest podcast and reaching out to his ex-wife for help to connect with, you know, former fiance of Donnie Jr., is actually a smart move because he's trying to see, okay, where did we go wrong as Democrats? However, let's see if we can tie in and come into a common ground. Is it too late to rebrand himself? Who knows? Also, my bigger question is it also because he's no longer under the shadow of Auntie Nancy, Nancy Pelosi? Nancy Pelosi is at the end of her career, though she's probably going to hold on with steely fingers like so many others. But is this an opportunity? Now, going back to former Vice President Harris, a source in Kamala's political orbit confirmed to Fox News that Harris has told allies she will decide by the end of the summer about whether to launch a gubernatorial campaign. And yet, here's another horse that's potentially in the running, and that is Harris's 2024 running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, is not ruling out a White House run of his own in 2028. Walz on Friday kicks off a high-profile town hall tour in Iowa, the state that, through the 2020 cycle, kicked off the Democrats' presidential nominating calendar. Meanwhile, three other prominent Democrats considered potential 2028 contenders are Governors Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, Andy Beshear of Kentucky, and Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania on Thursday are addressing the House Democrats' annual policy retreat. Even Rahm Emanuel, former congressman from Illinois, White House chief of staff in President Obama's administration, and Chicago mayor, who most recently served as U.S. ambassador to Japan, is potentially mulling a 2028 run. And this is just on the Democrat side. Remember, Trump can only serve through 2028. So we are going to have the Republican side too. And that's going to start getting interested because, of course, everybody thinks, oh, it's going to be our VP. Maybe not. So hold on to your boots. We are going to see some wild times. And while 2028 seems like a very long way away, the early moves in the next White House race begin, well, early for the party out of power. Governor Gavin Newsom's recent pitch to conservatives might seem surprising, but let's analyze this strategy. And honestly, I think he's being very smart about it. He has been getting some really good views. And if you look at the we the people under the 70% are against most of what the progressives have been pushing for the last 4 years under Biden. So Gavin Newsom making a pitch to conservatives with an eye toward 2028 seems absolutely plausible because it's really the independents that are up for grabs. If you can move yourself more and not just say you're moving into a more moderate centrist position, but actually looking at it. Because one thing's for sure, you got to get the independents if you're going to win a race. And this goes for senatorial, congressional, and presidential, because the independents are the vast majority of registered voters. It's only 28% Democrat registered voters and less than 25% Republicans, although Republicans have been making a gain. And as Newsom has prepared and launched his new podcast, the governor has been reaching out to Kimberly Guilfoyle, his ex-wife, and Donald Trump Jr.'s former fiance to connect with conservatives reviled by Democrats, you know, like his interview with Charlie Kirk or with Steve Bannon, a longtime Trump advisor. I mean, last week we discussed how Charlie Kirk was the first guest on Newsom's new podcast, where Newsom broke with many in his party on the issue of transgender women in sports and played down the notion that Democrats had overly focused on people's use of pronouns. In fact, saying that when he was in a meeting, everybody was making a big deal about pronouns. He thought it was ridiculous. Or also saying that it was very unfair. It was abundantly unfair for trans athletes to compete against women. Now, of course, he tried to hem and haw, which is Gavin's thing. Then all of a sudden goes, oh, but wait a minute, we have to have compassion and stuff. So he never really has a stance. But New York Times, everybody ran with it. He broke with the woke policies, which, again, he's not going to be able to get away with just saying, oh, it was abundantly unfair, when his own policies in California about children, teachers do not have to tell their parents if children are thinking that they may be trans or they may be non-binary. Also, the fact that if parents oppose a child, now remember, you cannot get a tattoo under the age of 17, and a parent can't get a child a tattoo if they're under 17. But if a child says they're trans and their parents are opposed to it, the state can take that child away and put them in foster care. This is Newsom. Remember that. But these moves of reaching out to super mega conservatives is actually opening a door or a pathway into a broader audience. It's not just the woke, it's the progressives, but it is a broader audience because there are many individuals like myself going, oh, well, wait a minute, I want to hear how he deals with Kirk, or how does he deal with other conservatives. And while Democrats are struggling to unite around a strategy to take on Trump and the GOP, Newsom is saying, you know what? We had a lot of failed policies that are not working. Our messaging is off. And maybe, just maybe, we need to figure out what it is about the conservative side or this MAGA side or this common sense side, and figure out how we can better pull as well as better reach we the people. And as these politicians plan their futures, thousands of federal workers face immediate uncertainty. After the break, we'll examine a massive shakeup in government employment that could change how America functions.
Getting back to our origin of We the People. Tackling current issues, both political and legal, with common sense. As We the People, we must bring common sense back to make our lives better. Only on Now Media TV.
Welcome back. The Education Department's workforce is facing unprecedented cuts. Nearly half its employees could lose their jobs. Trump's plan to dismantle the department to encounter several hurdles. The Education Department said Tuesday it was cutting its workforce by roughly half ahead of President Trump's expected executive order seeking to dismantle the federal agency, which was established by Congress in 1979. The department said it was cutting 1,950 staff positions in total, including 1,315 federal workers through reduction in force process announced Tuesday evening. Senior department officials said nearly 600 employees had accepted deferred resignations offers or voluntary buyouts, and an additional 63 probationary workers had been let go. The official said of the department's 4,133 total employees, 2,183 employees will remain at the department after the cuts, resignations, and buyouts. The official said it was eliminating full teams whose operations are deemed redundant or unnecessary, and those employees will receive full pay and benefits for 90 days and then severance pay based on their years of service. Federal workers at the agency received an email earlier Tuesday informing them that all department offices in Washington, D.C. region would close at 6 p.m. for security reasons, according to the email viewed by the Wall Street Journal. The official said the cuts would affect every part of the department, but called it a streamlining of preliminary internal-facing jobs affecting communications employees, office managers, human resource specialists, and information technology workers. And under these changes, the department will also cancel leases of buildings in San Francisco, New York, Boston, Chicago, Dallas, Cleveland, which, to be honest, to be fair though, have been sitting vacant since COVID and with employees refusing to go back into the office space. So why are we the people paying for all of these leases on empty offices? Also, as part of the reduction, Trump is consolidating a lot of these vacant office buildings and saying, we're moving you guys into one building so you guys can work here, into federal owned buildings, hence more savings. And this reduction in force notice had been anticipated to coincide with the Trump executive order, which is expected to call for Education Secretary Linda McMahon to facilitate the closure of the agency, according to people briefed on the plan. But the White House hasn't yet said when Trump will sign this order. And McMahon will face several hurdles in an effort to close the department, which she has referred to as the agency's final mission. Because remember, Trump does not have the authority to shut down the Department of Education, nor does McMahon. This must be done through Congress. And let's face it, it will be filibustered before you even get there. So it's really got to be the fact that you have to have, and it's probably going to be contingent on the 2026 midterm. Because in order to effectuate this, the tearing down and removal of the Department of Education, the Congress has to be able to pass it. They have to pass it. In order to pass it, you have to maintain a House stronghold, a stronghold in the House majority by the Republicans. But then the Republicans have to get a 60 person Congress, which I don't even know if that has been done. It has not been done in recent history. But this story just took a dramatic turn. A judge orders Trump administration to reinstate thousands of fired workers. This decision affects probationary workers at six federal agencies, including Treasury, Defense, and Energy. A federal judge has ordered six federal agencies to reinstate thousands of probationary employees who were fired last month, dealing a blow to the Trump administration's efforts to rapidly scale back the size of federal workforce. U.S. District Judge William Alsup in California said Thursday that probationary workers from the Departments of Agriculture, Energy, Interior, Treasury, Defense, and Veterans Affairs had been unlawfully fired. The order didn't extend to other agencies affected by the firings, although Alsup didn't rule out potentially expanding that in the future. Barring those deemed mission critical for the agency, probationary workers, those in their jobs for less than a year or less than 2 years for expected service, were sent an email stating that they were being let go for performance-related reasons. More than 200,000 employees, or nearly 10% of the civilian federal workforce, have been on the job for a year or less at the time, according to the Office of Personnel Management Data. Such a designation can also include recently promoted employees. Alsop, a nominee of former President Bill Clinton, said in remarks delivered from the bench that he wasn't questioning the government's authority to lay off workers, but he added it needed to be done through the proper legal procedures. It's a sad day when the federal government would fire a good employee and say it's based on performance when they know good and well that's a lie, Alsop said. He pointed to the employees who were told they were fired for cause despite stellar performance reviews. That should not be done in our country, he further states. It was a sham to avoid statutory requirements. Alsup also criticizes the Justice Department for what he characterized as attempts to stonewall the challengers in their attempts to gather more details about the firings, including attempts to depose acting OPM Director Charles S. L. The Trump administration has been cutting staff across federal agencies, mainly led by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. Evercore ISI estimates that DOGE's efforts will directly or indirectly result in nearly 500,000 fewer jobs. Now, this isn't the first time that we've had a federal government reduction. Remember, back in, or look up for those of you who were not around during this time, under President Bill Clinton's administration with Al Gore, they went and strategically, because they stated the same thing. We were under a deficit. Remember, we have a $36 trillion deficit and it's growing. Our government is outspending what it's coming in by more than $2 trillion a year. It has to stop. You and I could not manage our households like this. You and I could not manage our businesses like this. And again, under Clinton, there was a reduction of 100,000. I know my dad was working for the government. You know what? That spurred him to start a business, an incredibly successful international corporation with two other individuals that were also laid off during the Clinton era. So where do we go from this? Well, right now you have attorney generals from Democratic states. Democratic attorney generals are filing lawsuits left and right against all of what Trump is doing. And they are furthering attacking the Department of Education's layoffs, trying to state that this is going to cause disruptions in equal access to schools and things. Which, now, remember, the Department of Education, I'm going to go there real quick. Yes, they provide funding to the state, but overall the curriculums, the guidelines are dictated by the individual state. And that's what Trump keeps saying. He goes, the Department of Education, which was created less than 50 years ago, has taken so much control and has been pushing an ideology onto universities, public schools, and such, but also has been ineffective in the way that they have been managing the thing, that it's best that the local governments take over. And no. And honestly, maybe it is time. When we have eighth graders that can't read on a fourth grade level, when we have 40% of eighth graders not reading on their grade level, that is a problem. And having covered government policy for years, I can tell you this level of disruption is unprecedented. And we're going to be constantly going on. I don't even know a roller coaster would suffice. I think it's more of like the old fashioned carnival rides that was like the boomerang. You were spinning, and it would pull you out and pull you back. We are in this. But these stories from the University of Columbia to Congress, from campaign trails to government halls, share a common thread. Institutions that have defined American life for generations, at least three generations or four generations, if you look back at 1979, are under pressure to change. And we, the people, are the ones who have been saying we want change. There was change in 2020 being called out. Now there's change coming back. But the one change that seems to be the biggest voice is bring back common sense. Reduce government. Bring back common sense. Get our budgets under control. Have a balanced budget where we're actually being able to pay off this federal debt so our great-great-grandchildren will actually still have a country and be able to survive. The question now is, the question isn't if they'll change, but how and who will guide that transformation. I'm Alina Gonzalez-Dockery, and this has been We the People. Thank you for joining us, and I bid you all a good night.